All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry and I get to be your host today on Veterans Radio. I was a Chief Warrant Officer's second class in the United States Army during the Vietnam War. I flew helicopters over there for a year, came back mostly undamaged, as they say. No physical wounds, right? I'm very fortunate. Welcome again to this program. We're really excited. We're going to be talking with a lot of people today about a lot of different great topics, I think. Number one is that we're going to be talking about the War Dog Memorial here in, or the War Dog Monument here in Michigan. Then we're going to be talking about the poppies on the Washington Mall that are going to be up there on over Memorial Day weekend. And then finally at the on the third half of the program, as they say, we're going to be talking about an upcoming series on the Smithsonian Channel called Carriers at War, and we're going to learn all about aircraft carriers today. So I want to make sure that you are tuned in. If you'd like to get in on the conversation on Veterans Radio, the local number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. And if you want to call us from anywhere in the world toll-free, it is 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET-1600. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, all the other ones. I can't even remember what they all are, but we'd be more than happy to have you following us on Facebook, especially. As you know, we have a lot of podcasts that my partner Jim Falzone does pretty much every week. That's up on our website, veteransradio.net. Just click on podcasts, and he talks to a lot of very interesting people, got a lot of great stories, authors, and so forth. And, of course, you can always go to our website, veteransradio.net, and tune into our archives. We've got approximately close to 8 years worth of programs on there. As many of you know, Veterans Radio has been broadcasting now for 15 years, and we're pretty proud of that. And so we encourage you to go to our website and find out, or sign up for our newsletter and find out what's going on at Veterans Radio. Things are happening all the time. Well, for right now, I want to get right into my first guest, and that is Paul Whiteloff, who is the executive, I guess you could say, board of directors of the Michigan War Dog Memorial. And Phil, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much, Dale. It's nice to talk to you again.
It is nice to talk to you. I know there are many things that have been going on out there at the memorial, and I should remind our audience in southeastern Michigan that the War Dog Memorial is at the intersection of Milford Road and 11 Mile up in South Lyon, or is it South Lyon Township?
It's South Lyon with Lyon Township. So,
okay.
Close enough.
Well, let's give I know it's getting to be a longer story, which is really great, but give us a little background on what the War Dog Memorial is all about.
When we discovered the War Dog Monument that was located in this abandoned pet cemetery, we got together with several of our military veteran friends and some canine supporters, and we decided to try to clean it up. And as we continued cleaning, as the saying goes, kind of took a life of its own. And then it took us 2 years to clean the whole 2 acres up. And then in 2012, we renamed the area to the Michigan War Dog Memorial, with the idea that we would intern, retired military dogs when they passed away, and give them a complete a military burial. Which is kind of interesting because I got a hold of the DOD and asked them what is the proper procedures, and they really didn't have one. They said it's up to the unit of whatever they want to do with a military dog. So we decided that we would do and set up our own military procedure. And what we do is we have a bagpiper, we have a full color guard, we have 8 German shepherds escorting the remains to the table of honor. We have a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force reads the invocation. I usually read off the bio of the dog. Then we give the handler a folded American flag. We play taps on the bugle. We do Amazing Grace on the bagpipes. And those same 8 German shepherds have been trained to howl on command. And it's called a canine salute to their fallen comrade. and they do a semicircle in front of the table of honor, and they howl for 30 seconds.
Oh, my. We've got to get out there and record that one.
That's what we do for them.
That's awesome.
And, but, you know, the thing has grown so big now, and with all the residents in the area, the private donations, the corporations have stepped up. We have just turned it into a complete park setting now. And one of the big things that we did do, and that was last year, we wanted to honor all the Vietnam dogs that were left behind.
Right.
I don't know, a lot of people probably don't know that, but you know, at the end of the war, Congress felt they would be too dangerous and bring home diseases, and they gave the order to leave the dogs when they pulled out. So we wanted to honor them. So I started calling all over the United States. I'm trying to find the names because the DOD wouldn't even talk to me about it. So I kept calling. Finally, I happened to hit the right guy at the right time out in Maryland. And he happened to have connections in Congress. And I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, if you're going to build that wall for these dogs, he says, I will get you those names. And within a day, I had 4,234 names.
Wow.
And their tattoo numbers.
Right, because the military regarded them as equipment. So
that's
correct. They all had ID numbers tattooed into their ears, right?
It was considered excessive equipment and not needed anywhere else, and also the CDC felt it would be, you know, bring home diseases, which is a crock. That wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, it happened. They did. They were left. So last June, we dedicated a 22-foot by 4-foot black granite wall with all 4,234 names on it. And it was a big day. We must have had over 450 people show up for that dedication. And I had over 40 Vietnam dog handlers that came from everywhere to be present here. And at the tail end of the presentation that we were presenting and the dedication, I kind of just said, all right, all you handlers, go find your dog. Because we actually had it all covered up with a parachute.
Mm-hmm.
So we unveiled it, and no one had seen it up to that point. And so I asked them, I said, go find your dog. And they all went over there, and you could see them running their finger down the line and found their dog. And it was a very, very emotional day for them. After 50 years, their dog was finally recognized.
Well, I know a couple of local dog handlers, and they told me about that ceremony and how powerful and emotional it was for them, as you said, to run their fingers down there. And I, my wife and I took a trip up there shortly thereafter, and it's a fascinating, and it's a very moving memorial monument that you've got out there. And not just the one with the big giant German Shepherd on it, but you've got a lot of statuary starting to show up out there.
Oh yes. Yeah, our whole idea is we want to memorialize these canine heroes. You know, when people walk by and read their name, in my mind, they live on forever.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they are now memorialized at the Michigan War Dog Memorial. And it's open to the public. Anybody can come anytime they want. And as I said, we kept improving and doing things out there. And we've set it up into a complete park setting. One of the things that we also did is our committee sat down, and we have like a think tank. We do it once a quarter. What is our goal for next year? What are we going to do? What's the cost? And so on and so on. And we decided, let's open this up a little bit more. Let's talk about canines that sometimes spend their entire life serving us, not only the military that saves thousands of lives on the battlefield, but your police dog as well.
Right.
Police dog protects our partner in our communities. And the search and rescue dog finds our lost children,
mm-hmm.
or seniors who become confused. Our service dog to give the handicapped more independence. Our therapy dog that comforts the ill and the elderly. And our companion dog to give a soldier with PTSD a sense of security. That's what we open it up to now. And they're called our canine heroes.
Wow, that's a great thing that you're doing out there, Phil. And I understand that you've got a fundraiser going on right now, or coming up real shortly. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yes, one of the T-shirt manufacturer, not manufacturing stores over in Brighton at the Green Oaks Mall, the Big Frog, they call it.
Yeah, it's a Big Frog.
They made up a T-shirt, and they're going to be selling these for $10 each through the 1st of June, and 100% of the proceeds will be donated to the Michigan War Dog Memorial. Now, if somebody would like to go online and order them, they can. If they would go to my Facebook page, the Michigan War Dog Memorial Facebook page, you will find that link on there. You just click on it, and you can order it. But that's what I was saying before. So people have stepped up and said, "Hey, what can we do to help? You know, we like what you're doing for these canine heroes, and we want to be part of it." And that's kind of what's been happening.
Well, this is a great place for not only for war dogs, but it's a peaceful environment. I encourage people to go out to the Michigan War Dog Monument out there at 11 Mile and Milford Road. It's a beautiful job that you've done out there, but there's not only dogs out there, there are parrots, there are other pets of famous explorers and all kinds of things that you can look at, and especially with Memorial Day weekend coming up, this is a great opportunity for them to come out there, Phil, and let's give them your website again.
Yeah, the website is mwdm.org.
Okay.
mwdm.org.
Okay, it's up on our website. We hope that I hope to get out there and see you again real soon, Phil. And you can see the Canine Memorial Dog Dedication. All that is on there is a couple of other videos that are on their website. So get out there and do it. This is a great project, and it's going to be an ongoing one. Thank you very much, Phil, for being on Veterans Radio.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I appreciate it.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
All righty, bye-bye.
Okie dokie. All right, we're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about Poppies on the Mall. So stick around for that one. You're listening to Veterans Radio. All right, we're back on Veterans Radio, and that was Sousa's Washington Post March. That's as close as I could get to a song about Washington that I thought would be appropriate. But joining us on the program right now, excuse me, as I choke for a little bit, is, here it is. Got it now. All right, we're going to be talking about, there's a Poppy Memorial that is going to be on the Washington Mall this year. There's going to be 645,000 poppies to form a commemorative exhibit on the Washington, D.C. Mall. My guest right now to fill us in on all these things is John Byrd. He's a Vice Admiral, United States Navy retired, and he's also Senior Vice President of Military Affairs for USAA Insurance. So, Admiral, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good afternoon, Dale. It's a pleasure to be with you and a pleasure to be on your radio station. Thank you, too, for your service.
Thank
and again,
you.
I look forward to discussing the poppies.
Well, I guess I'll let you be the historian on this whole thing. A lot of us know the history of the poppy, but many of our audience do not. So, can you tell us why the poppy is so important to veterans?
Sure, Dale. Absolutely. So, at the end of World War I, a Canadian officer, Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, visiting the gravesite of a buddy of his who he had lost, saw the poppies growing up among the grave sites, and that resulted in him writing what is now a very famous poem, In Flanders Field. And he mentions that the poppies blow between the crosses row on row. 3 years later, Mona Michael, an American, wrote a poem that sort of challenged us to remember those that had given the last full measure in service to their country. And her poem was, "We shall keep the faith." And she said at the end of her poem, "Fear not that you have died for naught. We will keep the lesson that you wrought in Flanders Field," which is to say, we will remember. And she got the idea of taking a red poppy, which is what grows there, and wearing it on her lapel so that we all could remember those that had died in service to the country.
Wow, yeah, I'm looking at the website that I was given. It's it's called poppyinmemory.usacloud.com. Am I correct on that one?
And that is correct.
And it's It says that the poppy flower symbolizes that sacrifice and worry won on Memorial Day as a powerful way to honor these fallen heroes through action. You're going to have more than 645,000 poppies on the mall. What does that number signify?
Sure, Dale. Since World War I, the United States, Americans, 645,000 have died in conflict. World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, and through Afghanistan and Iraq. So the 645,000 poppies represents those men and women that paid the ultimate sacrifice. And it'll be displayed next to the reflection pool close to the Korean Memorial, these poppies, red poppies, with backlighting. And we think it will be very significant, very sombering, and behind it will be on the wall various infographics, if you will, describing the various wars where Americans have sacrificed their lives for our freedom.
Wow, that just sounds like such a powerful, powerful demonstration and exhibit that you're going to have there.
I would agree. You know, I had the chance. This wall was first constructed in 2016, and here at USAA in San Antonio, we had the wall displayed during our Memorial Day celebration. I can tell you it was very impactful and very inspiring. And you know, we all think of Memorial Day as sort of the unofficial start of summer. We think of barbecues, the pool opening up, picnics. But as you and I both know, and many of our listeners here today, the real purpose of Memorial Day is to remember and not forget those men and women that lost their lives in service to the country. And so I think this is a very impactful way, and wearing the poppy is a very small way to do that and to think about those men and women.
Well, I know that the various service organizations are out there, I don't want to use sites, they're giving away poppies for a donation, let's put it that way. And I know that all over our area here in Ann Arbor that the VFW and the American Legion are out trying to, you know, get people to be aware, because Memorial Day is much different than Veterans Day. And you know, in my mind, and I think probably in yours too, that Memorial Day is to memorialize those men and women who did lose their lives during whatever conflict that it was. Veterans Day is more to honor veterans themselves. Would you agree?
Totally. That's exactly right. And there's oftentimes confusion between the two. I think in some ways it's understandable, but the history of Memorial Day goes back to the Civil War when back then mainly women would go out and decorate the graves of their fallen husbands, sons, and brothers with flowers. And over the years that tradition was maintained to the modern day where we talked about wearing the poppy, but it's all about the fallen who died in service to their country. And to your point, Veterans Day, which interesting marks the end of World War I being November 11th, is all about in the U.S. recognizing any man or woman who served their country and is so-called a veteran.
Okay, well, do you mind if we take a phone call? I've got a question from somebody who wants to know about these poppies.
So, sure, right? No problem. I'm interested.
Okay, so David, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, yeah, afternoon. I'm glad you're discussing the this is the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One.
Correct.
And if I remember right, the disgust of people with that war, that it was basically to keep the monarchies alive. You know, the death of Archduke Ferdinand, who was probably one of the most hated men in Europe. He was he would basically use his diplomatic immunity to be a bad gambler, to be a bad drunk, to be a womanizer. He would
hold on, David. Let's get to the question of the poppies. That's why I've got the admiral here for you.
Well, it was that the if I understand right, the memorialization of all of the deaths were to make sure that war would never happen again. And that it was recognized that we did not want to keep those monarchies alive because they were going through all of their family infighting just to have a financial gain at our expense. And so the development of the poppies and the development of the memorial of the poppies was to make sure that war would never happen again. And shoot, hardly 20 years later, we had World War II. Then we've had nothing but a series of police actions without declarations of war. And so these numbers have racked up into what you're saying, 600,000. I'm wondering, actually, is there any development of, you remember that every soldier is supposed to have a right to refuse an illegal order. And is there any development of that refusal to take an illegal order?
That's a whole other program, David. But I want to thank
you. No, it isn't. It's whether we're going to go into World War III or whether we're going to allow a guy like a rich boy like Trump to have a war to make sure he doesn't.
I got to cut you off, David.
Oh, tough.
Sorry. Call again next week. Call next week. We'll talk about this issue more. Thank you very much. I'm sorry we got off on a little tangent there. But it's really, I guess the point, though, is there, Admiral, is that the poppies were to signify that that was going to be the end of, you know, the war to end all wars, correct?
Well, I would say World War I, there was the aspiration, the belief, as you just said, that it was the war to end all wars. And we know now, in retrospect, it's somewhat naive. And to think that we will never have war or armed conflict or lose men and women in service really is not naive, and it's very unfortunate. And as you remember, at the end of it, we first established, and it failed, the League of Nations, and then came the UN later to help stop this sort of thing. But unfortunately, I think evil will always be in the world, and we will have the rise of, at times, men like Hitler and the like, in which armed conflict seems to be the only solution. Now, nobody wants to go to war, but the best way to prevent it, in my mind, is have a very strong military. And for that, I am very thankful for the men and women that raise their right hand or are willing to serve, because that's our greatest guardian against more wars in the future. But we will lose men and women, and that is unfortunate. And so we should take Memorial Day to commemorate and recognize that great sacrifice. And that's what this poppy wall is all about, to recognize that men and women have sacrificed for our freedom. You know, freedom's not free, and you can see it's 645,000 lives. It is far from free.
No, it never is free, and nobody's going to take it from us, or, you know, that we're not going to give it up, you know, without a fight. And I think that's one of the issues. I mean, but I want to get back to the whole idea of the poppy exhibit that you're going to have. It's going to be such a powerful exhibition. How can people help this out?
Well, I would say, first and foremost, the way you help out is to talk about it, which is to say, mm-hmm. talk about what you and I are talking about, that Memorial Day is about reminding each other, certainly the young people, that this is about recognizing, commemorating those that have died for their country. The second thing, we actually have a virtual poppy wall for those that cannot visit at www.poppyinmemory.com. And you can go on there, and I've done this, and actually name a poppy, if you will, mm-hmm. for someone that you know, a loved one that you've lost, or just a person you're aware of that died in battle. And then finally, you can visit the mall if you're fortunate enough to be in D.C. during this Memorial Day weekend and see the poppy wall and have some education by looking at the displays. But most importantly, as a country, as citizens, we need to continue the education and do as Mona Michael said, and never forget and always keep the faith, remembering those that gave their lives for our freedom.
Absolutely, Admiral. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, we were just briefly talking. There is an organization called Veterans for War. Nobody wants to get into a war. We want to get in and get out as fast as we can. And we want to honor those that did pay that ultimate sacrifice. And that's what Memorial Day is all about. And so I encourage our listeners to go to the website, the poppyinmemory.com. It's a great site, and there are stories there. You can donate money, you can purchase a poppy, you can dedicate it to a friend or relative or someone that you know, and I encourage you to do that. And I want to thank you, Admiral Byrd, for being on Veterans Radio and for thanking USAA as well.
Well, thank you, Dale. It's been a pleasure. And thank you again for your service and for this radio station and all you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you again after this is over. I think it sounds like a great idea. It's something I'd like to talk about more.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you. All right. That was Vice Admiral John Byrd, who's the United States Navy, and he is the Senior Vice President of Military Affairs for USAA. For those of you that served in the military, or you see the ads on TV all the time now, USAA is an insurance company that is designed for military personnel and for veterans. This is not a paid political announcement, but that's what they were originally set up for, and they do a great job of supporting veterans' concerns and veterans' issues and so forth. So, again, I strongly recommend that you go to poppyinmemory.com. The sign on there is a poppy worn, a hero is honored, and that's what you can do this coming Memorial Day. We're going to be taking a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about aircraft carriers and what the Navy's got up their sleeves in the future and currently. And we'll be talking with a representative from the Smithsonian Channel. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We will be back after the news. Back here on Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be your host today, and we're going to be talking about aircraft carriers, which I find really exciting to myself. And there's a program going to be on tonight on the Smithsonian Channel. Actually, it's at 8 o'clock, and it's going to be starting a series of programs about the aircraft carrier. And so I encourage you to go to your local provider and find out where the Smithsonian Channel is on your network and check it out. It's going to be at 8 o'clock tonight, and it's going to be about carriers at war. And my guest right now is a Navy veteran, and his name is Brian McGrath. And Brian is a retired naval officer with over 25 years of experience. He was the lead strategist and primary author of the U.S. Navy's 2007 Maritime Strategy, and is an acknowledged expert in the fields of strategy, formulation, strategic planning, and strategic communication. And he's here to answer your questions today, so you can give us a call on Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600 or 844-838-1600. And, Brian, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. So let's talk about the Smithsonian series that they've got going here about the United States Navy's aircraft carriers.
Yeah, it's a four-part series, and my participation in the series is in actually the fourth part, the one that airs, I believe, on the evening of June the 10th. But what they're attempting to do is to give the American people a good sense of what their investment gets them, and how flexible and powerful these platforms are. I'm actually really looking forward to seeing the product of their work.
I think it's pretty exciting. Their representative sent me a link, so I was able to look at the one on the Ford carrier. That was fascinating. But tonight I want to remind people that they're looking at carriers in war, and it's going to start off with a strike force of the Arabian Gulf, I think is the one that's going to be on tonight. And that, again, is at 8 o'clock Eastern time on the Smithsonian Channel. So I encourage you to get into that. So since I've got you on as a resident expert on aircraft carriers, let's talk a little bit about them. How did the aircraft carrier come about?
Well, the aircraft carrier came about from smart people in the early part of the last century who saw that the airplane would change the face of war. And that because the Earth was covered by so much water, if you could get airplanes closer to the fight on ships, you could have a leg up in combat. And the 1920s, the U.S., both the Great Britain and the United States started working on it, and this led to the development of purpose-built aircraft carriers that could launch and recover strike aircraft from anywhere in, on the world's oceans.
Well, I know in today's world that the we all, those people my age anyway, you sound a little bit younger than I am, but you know, we grew up with all these the war stories and the movies about aircraft carriers and the planes coming in and you know, taking off, and I think it was the Doolittle raid where they, you know, they dropped their first bombs on Japan and so on and so forth. But now today's aircraft carrier is becoming much, much more sophisticated, and I guess that's what I think you would probably like to talk about more.
Well, yeah, I mean, the like most weapons of war over the last over the course of the seven decades that we've been operating aircraft carriers, the aircraft carrier has gotten increasingly sophisticated. Today's aircraft carriers are gigantic; they're 90,000 tons. They are nuclear powered, which means they whatever fuel they carry is devoted exclusively to their weapon system. Their weapon system consists of the airplanes that launch and recover from the deck of the aircraft carrier, which creates a unique situation among aircraft carriers when compared to any other warship, in that you can change the very character of the sensors and weapons on that ship, not by bringing it into a shipyard and tearing it up and cutting all kinds of holes in it and replacing radars and weapon systems, but by simply flying off certain aircraft and flying new ones on. And that has been the secret of the aircraft carrier's flexibility and sustainability over the course of the last seven decades, and that is that they can keep up with the threat more easily than any other kind of warship, because you simply have to swap out the airplanes that you want to use.
Well, I know in the promo that I was watching, you had Ospreys, you had, you know, helicopters, they had jets, they had all kinds of things landing on the deck of the Gerald R. Ford, which is the newest. Am I correct? The newest aircraft carrier.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
So tell me a little bit about the Gerald R. Ford. We have a little connection here in Ann Arbor, of course, to Gerald Ford.
Of course you do.
Considering he played football here and the president and all these other different things. But tell me about this incredible aircraft carrier.
Well, it's the first new design aircraft carrier in the country since the 1960s. It is the ship that will replace the Nimitz-class aircraft carriers that we have now. We have 11 of them, and over time, about every 5 years, a new Ford-class carrier will be built. It does all the same things that old aircraft carriers did, which is specifically launch and recover aircraft. It does it with two very powerful and what's called power-dense nuclear power plants, four propellers. These things move incredibly fast, very fast, close to 40 knots.
Wow!
And you know, it's the beauty of the Ford is that you can be conducting operations in one part of the ocean, and the next day you could be 800 miles away and conducting operations in another part, and that's, again, one of the secrets to the aircraft carrier's power, is that you can move it. Is that it's hard to target. It's hard to stay with it. And this is as opposed to, say, land-based air, which you know, if you know what the coordinates of the airstrips are, the airfields or the hangars that the aircraft are kept in, they're pretty easily targeted.
And that's sort of probably as a reaction to Pearl Harbor, you know, when not only were the ships but the airplanes that were stationed in Pearl Harbor were wiped out, and the I don't know, this I'm just reading about this aircraft carrier, and it's $14 billion and 13 years to build, and how big is this thing?
Well, it's gigantic. It's over 1,000 feet long. It's, as I said, 90,000 tons. By comparison, the ship that I commanded was about 9,000 tons. And it was a destroyer. It was a, you know, one of the larger, more sophisticated warships on Earth. These are massive. These are nuclear powered airports that move and move rapidly, and they are among the most sophisticated pieces of military technology ever imagined by man. And so you mentioned the cost of the aircraft carrier. For that investment, the American people will get 50 years of lifespan. It'll get probably 25 to 30 long deployments. There will be, you know, literally scores of different kinds of aircraft that will take off and land over the on that carrier over the course of its 50-year lifespan. I am often asked about the cost of aircraft carriers, and I am a big fan of the value we get from them. There is nothing in the American military arsenal quite as flexible and powerful as an aircraft carrier, and if it costs $14 billion, that's what we ought to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there aren't a lot of aircraft carriers in the world, are there?
No, I don't know the exact number, but there's probably less than a dozen or 15, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. I know that's one of the things that people keep asking about. You know, how come other countries don't have aircraft carriers? And I understand that there are some other countries that are in the process of trying to build them, but it doesn't sound like they're going to try to build anything like this. How many crewmen are there on the Gerald Ford?
I'd say there's about 4,500 between those that are associated with the ship itself and those that are associated with the air wing. I'd like to comment on something you just said and maybe educate some listeners and remind others. The fact that we have 11 aircraft carriers and no one else has more than two, I don't think. People often will say, well, use that as some sort of a case that, well, why do we need so many? And the bottom line is we need so many because of the unique circumstances of both our place in the world and our geography. We are the world's most powerful diplomatic, military, and economic power. We have widely flung interests all over the world. We have a network of allies. We have a network of interests. And our economy is utterly dependent on the free movement of goods across the surface of the earth. We're very, very gifted in our geography because we have friends to the north and friends to the south. But we are far away from many of our interests and many of our economic interests. And having a large navy and having a navy that can project power and having a navy that can, in an unrivaled manner, keep the seas free for commerce is something that works to the benefit of our economy and is quite frankly, the kind of thing that means jobs and prosperity in the United States of America. And so when people try to compare our Navy to other navies in the world, my answer is always, there is no country like ours in the world, therefore there is no other Navy like ours.
Well, I strongly agree with you on that one. It's, you know, as you mentioned, we have to maintain a two-ocean Navy because of our geographic location. You know, it's kind of unusual to have, oceans on both sides. And I think, as you mentioned also, because of our political agreements around the world that we need to maintain a very strong Navy. And the Navy is a lot more involved, I think, than many people realize.
Well, I mean, there are somewhere around 280 ships in today's Navy. About 100 of them are out and about, deployed around the world, conducting exercises, showing the flag, being powerfully present where other nations may seek to do violence against our interests or the interests of our friends or allies. And what's interesting is that 100 ships deployed out of 282 is about the same level of daily deployed ships we had when the Navy was over twice as big. So we are getting a considerable amount out of a smaller Navy to cover commitments on a world that has gotten no smaller.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about technology and we can talk about ships being more powerful as much as we want, but the bottom line is it's still thousands of miles to the Arabian Gulf. It's still thousands of miles to the Sea of Japan. The world gets no smaller. Our interests do not get more modest. The requirements for the Navy remain strong, and in my opinion, we are not meeting them.
Oh, really? Okay. We can come back to that in a little bit. I want to remind everybody here that we are talking with Brian McGrath about the series on carriers that is coming up on the Smithsonian Channel starting tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Check your local carrier to see where the Smithsonian Channel is going to be on your dial. And I'd strongly suggest that you look at these. I've got the opportunity to look at a couple of them. And they're fascinating stories. I mean, these are cities that are moving around. Brian just, you know, reminded us that there are 4,500, that's 4,500 sailors on the Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier, and that's bigger than most of the towns around our area. That's a pretty big commitment there. What does I'm not in the Navy, so I always need Navy experts around me. I tried to get one, and he couldn't come today. I'm Army. What do I know? So tell me what surrounds an aircraft carrier when it goes out on patrol?
Well, typically these days there are quite a bit fewer ships than in the Cold War. When I first came in the Navy in 1987 and I deployed to the Mediterranean the following year, I think we had 12 or 13 ships in our strike group. Your average strike group today will go out with the aircraft carrier and all of the different kinds of aircraft that are on it. It will have an attack submarine associated with it, but not operating tightly coupled with it. And it will have perhaps two destroyers and a cruiser, or one cruiser and one destroyer. It has just a few escorts, and then finally some sort of a multi-product logistics ship will be associated with that carrier. And from this group of perhaps six ships, more naval power is generated than any other Navy on Earth can with any of their formations.
Are these ships resupplied? Could I have to pull it to port, or what happens?
Yeah, you have we maintain a global system of logistics ships, and some of them are quite large, and what they do is go in and out of port and grab fuel and grab groceries and parts and all sorts of things, and they come out and meet the ships, and they conduct replenishment at sea, either a connected replenishment or a vertical replenishment using a helicopter. You can also use those ships that are going into port to come back out and just transfer fuel and transfer goods to the supply ship that is with the strike group, in a console method or a bucket brigade method. But this concept of logistics is something that the Navy thinks about quite a bit and puts a lot of money into, and quite frankly, it's something that I think we have to think more seriously about going ahead as the president talks to us about great power dynamics and great power competition.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me that you have these ships out there, you know, on missions wherever it is that they're going, and I'm always fascinated by the idea of that these ships get right next to each other, they throw a line over, and then there's storms and waves and all these other things, and people are going back and forth, and food are going back and forth. It's a dangerous job.
It can be. There is a certain amount of incompressible and irreducible amount of danger, but you do your best to compress and reduce it by training. And that, mm-hmm. that, like any military function, whether it be land, sea, or air, you must have the time to train and the equipment and the resources to train so that when the time comes to do it for real, you're ready and safe in doing it.
I know. You got to get that muscle reflex thing going.
Absolutely.
muscle memory, right? That's what it was.
Absolutely.
What else can you tell me about the USS Gerald R. Ford without giving away secrets? Is there anything unusual about the landing and takeoffs of the aircraft?
Yeah, the ship is fitted with some interesting new gear. For the longest time, we have used steam-driven catapults to propel airplanes off the deck of the aircraft carrier, and steam-driven devices for restraining them when they land. Both of those functions are now on this carrier for the first time in history anywhere worldwide are carried out by electromagnetic means. And this launching system and this recovery system are designed to be first and foremost to be less manpower intensive. When you have steam systems, you have a lot of steam valves, and valves have to be maintained, and piping has to be maintained, and electromechanical systems are somewhat less manpower intensive. So you can have fewer sailors, and that's one of the things we have in the Ford, both as a virtue of its higher technology nuclear plant and these electromagnetic auxiliary systems. The number of people to run this carrier is considerably less than the Nimitz class.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy maintains or estimates that over the course of the 50 years, this ship would be $4 billion total less expensive to operate than a Nimitz would. The second thing that these electromagnetic launch and recovery systems do is they allow for a more sensitive means of altering how much power is transmitted to the airframe when you're launching it. The launching and recovery of airplanes from an aircraft carrier is a jarring event, and the more you jar those planes over time, the less life you have in them. The structural dynamics of the ship just begin to break down after a while, and so if you're able to launch the plane with just enough power to get it off the deck along with the ship's engines, rather than a more gross or blunt force launch, you're able to get more lifespan out of the course of the of those airframes, and that offers the opportunity for long-term life cycle savings in what we pay for aircraft.
I would think so, because again, you know, just the idea of these airplanes are thrown off, basically they're thrown off the aircraft carrier, pushed, let's put it that way, really fast. And I think
they are essentially shot off the aircraft carrier.
Right. Yeah. So they're getting the stress to the body, and the, it's like driving your car on Michigan roads right now.
There you go.
And, everything is shaking apart every time you do that. I just think that this is such an opportunity. Let's talk about you mentioned that how high tech that the USS Gerald R. Ford is. Talk about can you talk a little bit about the training that the sailors have to have just to be on this ship?
So
how well trained, I guess.
There are two things that every sailor fears: fire and flood. When a farmhouse is burning in Michigan, the firefighters have the opportunity, and let's say all the people are safe. The firefighters have the opportunity to stand outside the fire and pour water into it. When you have a fire on board a ship, you can't fight it that way. You have to get at the base of the fire. You have to get at the source of the fire. And so every human on board an aircraft carrier has a basic level of damage control, the ability to help in the event of a fire. The other thing, as I said, is flooding that everyone fears. And so in a sort of at a basic sense, everybody knows how to help fight damage, fire and flooding. That's the table stakes for being on the ship. Now, there, what we do, like a good capitalist society, is that we divide our people into expertise, and they do what they're best at. We have people who are who work on electronics gear. We have people who work on mechanical systems. We have people who work on the nuclear power plant. We have people who work on airplane engines. We have people who work on airplane electronics. All of those skills are divided into various stages of expertise, and the crew members, the sailors who do those things, have journeyman level apprentice level training, and then journeyman level training, and then expert level training as they proceed through the ranks. So you have a great span of experience and expertise throughout the various specialties that help make an aircraft carrier go. It really is quite a sophisticated system. And again, someone has to feed all those people, right? So there is an amazing logistics operation of, you know, several meals a day and if you're doing flight ops around the clock, you've got to feed people around the clock. It's quite a system.
It certainly sounds like, and I strongly encourage everybody to tune into the Smithsonian Channel tonight to start the series of Carriers at War. It's on 8 o'clock. It's going to be Strike Force Arabian Gulf is the program tonight, and then every Sunday evening at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, there's going to be a different story about aircraft carriers in the Navy up to the Gerald R. Ford, which I believe is on June 10th. So I encourage people to look at those. I want to thank you, Brian, very much for being on Veterans Radio. This is most informative, and it's kind of really fascinating to know and great to know where our tax dollars are going and that this is looks like something that's going to be fun. So thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you. We'll talk to you again. All right. Another Veterans Radio is in the can, as they say. I encourage you to go to the Smithsonian Channel 8 o'clock. Next week, we'll be back on Veterans Radio. We're going to be talking not really sure, but it's going to at least have some benefits experts on again, and we're talking about Memorial Day. Make sure you get out to that local parade. Make sure you buy your poppies. This is Dale Thronberry from Veterans Radio. Until next time, you are dismissed.